We present today a couple of ways to think about this economic crisis. As a lesson from crises past, as a sonic reimagining of those plain old stock charts, and as a new way to think about one's business. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday, today the end of what has felt like an endless March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. What we have here in this crisis is in some ways a straight-up supply and demand problem. And here's what I'm talking about. We are not using as much stuff as we were even a couple of weeks ago. There's just not a whole lot of demand. But in some parts of the global economy, supply is still going strong, and that imbalance is leading to some out-of-the-ordinary problems. If you've been following oil at all, you know this. And if not, well, here you go. The U.S. benchmark is down around $20 a barrel, staggeringly low. Air travel is down. There's way less driving. Not a whole lot of demand. But all the oil that's out there and the oil that is still being pumped has got to go somewhere, right? And as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, storage of commodities is the real hot commodity right now.
The U.S. has the infrastructure to store unused oil, whether it's in old salt caverns along the Gulf Coast or oil tankers that float offshore. But Jim Burkhardt at IHS Markets says with demand plummeting, that storage is reaching full capacity.
The infrastructure is not built to handle a 20-25% overnight collapse in oil demand.
Thing is, there are reasons why a producer would keep pumping oil now. Burkhardt says shutting down a drilling rig can damage a reservoir. Tom Tsang at the University of Tulsa says smaller producers might have to keep pumping oil, despite the low prices they're getting for it.
Even though on the books it's going to be a loss, they've got to have some cash flow to maintain operations.
And that's just in the U.S. Matt Smith is director of commodity research at Clipper Data, which tracks flows of crude oil around the world. He says the oil production war going on overseas will dump even more crude onto the market.
We're going to be seeing a lot of barrels coming to market in the next few weeks, not only from Saudi Arabia, but likely from Russia, United Arab Emirates.
Smith says the price of storage is shooting up. Oil tanker rates have reportedly doubled from last week. Jim Burkhardt at IHS Markets says if storage capacity runs out, U.S. oil production might have to start shutting down.
At current production levels, the oil supply surplus will exceed the ability to store it. So something's got to give.
He estimates that by next year, U.S. production could drop by nearly a third. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Uncertainty is probably the byword of this crisis so far for people and businesses and entire industries, really, including healthcare, specifically, given that this is actually a healthcare-induced economic crisis, right? So what consumers are going to end up paying for healthcare down the road is an issue. Covered California, the state health insurance marketplace out here, has a report out estimating COVID testing and treatment is going to cost anywhere from $34 to $251 billion, which it says could show up as a bump in insurance premiums of 4% all the way up to 40%. Now, yes, those are huge spreads. I grant you that. But those are spreads that are huge because, as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports, figuring out who is paying for all of this is incredibly complicated.
It would be nice to believe that no one is thinking about healthcare bills right now, but the bills will come. Some will get picked up by Medicaid and Medicare, private insurers, individuals, but...
So some of the costs of treating patients with coronavirus are just not being paid for at all.
And that means some clinics and hospitals are eating the costs for now, says Ativ Mehrotra, who teaches healthcare policy at Harvard. And while there may be a surge of hospital visits for COVID-19,
patients are understandably scared to go get healthcare. So a lot of other forms of healthcare have been reduced.
These discussions about coronavirus costs and who will pay them are already happening. Benjamin Isger leads the Health Research Institute at PwC.
If we're thinking about the employer insurance market, you know, this is the time period when health plan actuaries are starting to think about what next year's costs will be.
Costs that factor into healthcare premiums paid by employers and individuals. And health plans don't have a lot of data to go on right now. What will the government end up covering? How many people will eventually need care?
Are there a lot of procedures that are being put off? And so then will there be even additional procedures in the coming year?
All we really have right now is a whole lot of uncertainty. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Wall Street on this Tuesday at the end of a month that is going to be in the history books. More down than up, but honestly, kind of mellow. Relatively speaking, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. To recap the situation here briefly, macroeconomic indicator-wise, more than 3 million people filed first-time claims for unemployment the third week of March. We'll get this week's first-time claims day after tomorrow, and then on Friday, the first monthly unemployment report since things started going south. And I'm going to hazard a guess here that one of the big economic questions on people's minds is how bad are things going to get? So, history buff that I am, I thought it'd be a good idea to get a hold of a bunch of historians to talk about economic crises past, and in particular, the Great Depression, and what it might be able to tell us about what we ought to be looking for today to see where we might be going tomorrow. Kathleen Day teaches at Johns Hopkins. She's also the author of a book on the history of financial crises in this country. It's called Broken Bargain. She joins us. Well, yeah, she joins us from home.
Maybe I should go to the sunroom where no one will come barreling in. All right, I'll get out of the kitchen. Hold on.
We'll wait. I'm home too. We get it. Panelist number two is Eric Hilt. He's an economic historian at Wellesley College, also working from home.
I spent this morning inside a couch fort constructed by my six-year-old daughter, reading to her.
Finally, Carola Friedman. She's a professor of finance at Northwestern, who right now is sharing a makeshift home office with her husband.
And sort of trying to navigate that with a toddler.
All right, first question to the panel. What started the Great Depression anyway?
Okay, so it's important to distinguish between the stock market crash in October of 1929 that everybody knows about and the Great Depression itself.
Okay, noted. But how did it happen?
The first problem leading up to the Great Depression was that the Fed failed, bank regulators failed to put on the brakes to risky lending for speculative stock market. So there was a stock market bubble and people were investing like crazy.
Somehow it didn't last forever.
We all know about the stock market crash of late 1929.
It was panic. 16.5 million shares of stock sold in a single day.
The collapse of the stock market gave an increase in uncertainty, so individuals stopped consuming.
It was the forerunner of depression and crisis.
So the economy started to contract in probably summer of 1929, but it became a Great Depression rather than a severe recession, probably starting in 1930. When a wave of bank failures started to occur.
Okay, wait. You catch that?
It became a Great Depression rather than a severe recession when a wave of bank failures started to occur.
Banks by the hundreds, by the thousands are forced to close.
On the also, banks didn't know who to lend.
The whole financial system quakes and totters.
So the tipping point that led to what we think of as the Great Depression was banking crises rather than a stock market crash.
The Great Depression started when those banks failed. Businesses couldn't get loans anymore, so they couldn't do business.
The reason that the Great Depression was the Great Depression was that the financial system essentially melted down. And for the most part, the Fed did very little to try to stop that.
It didn't act as a lender of last resort to many banks, which also contributed greatly to the depth and breadth of the Depression.
So what we've learned from that is that you need to be able to inject liquidity in a moment of crisis. You need to be able to bail out banks so that banks can keep on lending and restore confidence.
Sound familiar? Bailing out banks to keep the economy going?
So the Great Recession of 2008 to 2012.
Ben Bernanke, who is a student of the Great Depression,
bailed out the banks.
Okay, but wait. The Great Depression was the Great Depression. The Great Recession was the Great Recession. And this ain't those yet.
This episode is very different from the Great Depression.
Crises in the past have been a little bit different than this one.
But there's no doubt that there's some economic rough water ahead.
So today, we are seeing policymakers acting very quickly.
Jay Powell and the Fed have cut interest rates to basically zero. They've started buying bonds, trillions of dollars in bonds to put more money into the financial system. They've lowered the rates they charge banks to borrow money and a whole lot more. So then, panel, what should we be watching to help us understand what kind of crisis this might turn out to be?
Unemployment, of course.
Unemployment claims.
The unemployment rate.
Credit delinquencies.
Credit markets.
Credit for small businesses.
Significant and prolonged deflation.
Decline in prices.
And bankruptcies.
The caveat here is that this is an economic crisis the likes of which nobody alive has ever seen, so even the experts don't know exactly what is going to happen. Thanks again to our experts, our panelists, Kathleen Day at Johns Hopkins, Eric Hilt at Wellesley, and Carola Friedman at Northwestern. One of the many, many things in this economic life that have basically evaporated the past couple of 3 weeks is the simple pleasure of browsing in a bookstore. And for a lot of the independent booksellers out there with already tight margins, that is a real threat to their existence. So they're looking for new ways to connect with potential customers, which is what you call a business opportunity for a company called Bookshop.org. Here's the company's founder on what that has been like.
My name is Andy Hunter, and I'm the founder and CEO of Bookshop.org. Bookshop.org is an online store for books. So we've got independent local bookstores that use it to sell books to their customers. We have bloggers and newspapers and magazines that are linking to Bookshop to earn affiliate revenue. And we've seen a steady rise in book sales. And in the past 4 days, we've seen it dramatically rise. We're now selling about 800% of what we were selling 4 weeks ago. And we've got five people. So having orders increase 800% is definitely a strain on us. But I really count ourselves lucky because I think everybody's, you know, a little worried. Nobody knows how long this is going to last. And small businesses with low margins, they don't really have the funds to shutter their doors for 8 weeks. And so any online shopping that can offset the loss of foot traffic that they're getting is very welcome and desperately needed.
That's Andy Hunter. He is the founder and CEO of Bookshop.org, which, by the way, is, as of today, formally partnering with the publisher Simon & Schuster. Coming up,
we've never made medical equipment before.
They have, though, designed and built cars. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials sank 410 points today, 1.8%, closed at 21,917. The Nasdaq sagged 74 points, 0.9%, 7,700 even. The S&P 500 down 42, 1.6%, ended at 2,584. But honestly, kind of mellow, right? Simon Property Group fell 2.5%. Today, the biggest U.S. mall owner has furloughed 30% of its workforce. Gap is a tenant in a lot of Simon's closed malls. Gap tumbled 5.1% today after announcing it's going to furlough 80,000 of its retail workers. Bond prices rose. When that happens, the yield goes down. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 0.66%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Let your employees know you've got their back by signing up for Gusto for payroll and HR. More than 300,000 small business owners use Gusto. They offer benefits like health insurance, employee onboarding, and more. Get your payroll taxes filed, deductions calculated, and your team paid fast. No more pain. Just the joy of running your business. Get 3 months free when you go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. The defining marker of this crisis, so far we ought to say, because come Friday it's going to be unemployment, but the early telltale sign that something evil was this way coming was the stock market going bananas. Volatility is the technical term for that, and if you've spent even a minute looking at a stock chart, you know all the ups and the downs are a bit overwhelming. So how about some sound, an audio representation of the movements of the Dow Industrials January 2nd up to last Friday. That's the 27th of March. Here you go. That was 12 or so seconds of sound. It's the creation of Jordan Werf's Brock. She's a PhD student in information science at the University of Colorado, and we've gotten her on the phone to explain. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks.
So let's do a little definition here first. Sonification is what?
Sonification is any technique for taking sounds and using those to convey data or information. So that could be anything from an alarm to an algorithmically composed piece of music.
Part of what we have to do here, I think, in this interview, right, is train people how to listen to this thing?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Like, we've all been looking at bar charts and line graphs our whole lives, but we haven't been listening to data in this way.
Right. So that thing we heard up in the introduction, first of all, what did it represent? Give me time span and, I guess, general parameters.
Yeah, so what we just heard was the Dow Jones Industrial Average from the beginning of the year, back on January 2nd, up until last Friday. And the two metrics that you heard were the daily percentage change, that's representing the volatility, and then also the closing value. So that's representing the longer-term trend.
Okay, so let's take your volatility metric first. We'll play just a little bit of that. And this is the sound, in essence, of a flat day.
Yeah, so we just heard a piano, so that's representing the daily percent change, and it's doing a little arpeggio, and this is just a flat day, so I believe we're hearing something like a 0.2% increase, and so it's just kind of in the middle of the piano's range, the middle of the keyboard there.
All right, so let's listen now to a big up day, I guess, of which there have been many, right, the past couple of 3 weeks, and here's what that sounds like.
Yeah, so that was actually the biggest daily increase, an 11% plus increase. Mm. So you hear those really high notes up and down over there at the top of the piano range.
And then the flip side, of course, is a big down day, which is this. All right, so let's call this a midterm exam here if we're training people how to listen to this stuff. We're going to play, I guess it's a 2 week segment of regular plain old volatility, and then we're going to come back. So here it is.
Yeah, so that was back at the beginning of the year, way back in January, which hard to even remember what that was like,
yeah,
right?
No
and
kidding.
You just hear it's just kind of flat. Things aren't changing. They're kind of boring. They're kind of steady. So we're hearing a little bit of increase, but really things overall aren't really doing much.
Okay, now here's some craziness from more recently. Here you go.
Yeah, so that was the past 2 weeks where you can hear those really, really high notes and those really, really low notes. Those are those days with the big increases and the days with the big drops. And you can hear they're just kind of interspersed. So things are up and down and up and down, and it's just all kinds of craziness.
Right. Can I ask you about timing here for a second? How do you, I mean, the 11-second clip we played in the beginning, that was like 3 months of the market, right? So what's your time frame? What's your reference frame?
Yeah. So what I did was I sped it up so that you can hear 5 days in a second. So each single day is going to be 0.2 seconds. And that's so that you can hear the whole thing in about 12 seconds. You know, if this thing was really long, if it was like 20 minutes, no one would want to listen to it, right?
Yes, that is true. And also this entire show is only 20 minutes and 45 seconds. Okay. So we had two metrics, the first one of which was volatility. The other one is the daily closing price, right?
Right. And this is just so we can kind of hear that progression of those longer term trends, right? We do care that the market overall has gone down. We're in a bear market now. So we want to hear, you know, is it going up? Is it going down? And that's what the closing value is going to tell us.
Okay. So let's play, a high closing price, right? And that's what this would sound like.
Yeah, so that was a bass, right? So that's the instrument that you're hearing, kind of an upright bass. And so that was a high day. I believe this was back in February when it was over 29,000. And you can hear that's at the upper register of that bass instrument's range.
And then low bass is low price, yeah?
That's right.
It's funny the way that works, huh? Okay, so as you sit there as a PhD student in information science, what do you want people to get out of this?
Yeah, so I think that listening to data as opposed to looking at it can really invite people to reflect and engage in a different way. You kind of pause and you're like, oh, what's that? And you kind of pay attention to new dimensions. So the dimensions that I really wanted to bring out here was that volatility, which is actually something I learned from listening to Marketplace, is that it's not just which direction things are going, right, but how much they're swinging day to day. And so at the beginning of the sonification, things are kind of moving along, chugging along, everything sounds kind of boring. And then toward the end of it, things get crazy, right? They're just kind of up and down and up and down. Mm-hmm. And so you can just hear that difference in the whole texture of what the DAO is doing.
All right, here it is. We're going to play it one more time, the whole 12 seconds. Jordan Werfsbrock, she's a PhD student at the University of Boulder, Colorado, studying information science. Jordan, thanks a lot. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks so much. It's been fun.
The thing about a global pandemic is that it's global. So what we're seeing as this thing makes its way around the planet are the same or similar sets of problems repeating themselves. Case in point, ventilators and the United Kingdom. The National Health Service over there is dangerously short of them. There are only a couple of domestic manufacturers, and would-be foreign suppliers are focused on their own markets. So the government has appealed to British engineering. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Britain's National Health Service has just over 8,000 ventilators. It says it needs at least 30,000, and it needs them now. Health Secretary Matt Hancock made this extraordinary appeal to the whole of Britain's engineering industry.
We want anybody who has the manufacturing capability to turn to manufacture ventilators to do that.
More than 3,000 companies making a wide variety of products have offered to help.
With DC59, Dyson has engineered a cordless vacuum cleaner that sucks up as much...
Among the would-be ventilator makers, Dyson is best known for its vacuum cleaners and hair dryers. Rolls-Royce makes jet engines, JCB mechanical diggers. And then there's ProDrive. The company, based here 80 miles northwest of London, makes racing and rally cars. Spokesman Ben Sayer describes ProDrive as one of the world's leading motorsport companies.
What makes you think you can make ventilators?
What we're very good at here is being able to manufacture and assemble complex systems very quickly.
He says the company is immensely proud of its high-tech engineering skills.
But you've never made medical equipment before.
We've never made medical equipment before. But we've made lots of equipment that is quite similar, but not specifically for the medical environment.
But that's the problem, says one critic of the government scheme. Professor of Management at the University of Edinburgh Business School, Nick Oliver, says these high-tech volunteers like ProDrive, Dyson, Rolls-Royce and the others lack one skill that's vital in ventilator making.
It's understanding that the medical environment, as distinct from the environment of the racetrack, or the open road. These are very, very different environments.
Assembling such a complex and sensitive piece of life-saving equipment as a ventilator and making it work is a tall order, he says.
I think the idea that manufacturers, even very skilled manufacturers, who are not well-versed in the art of producing medical devices, can suddenly turn on production of such devices is a little optimistic, to say the least.
Andrew Rayner of ME Medical, which makes ventilator components, is also sceptical about the government turning to non-medical companies for these vital devices.
I can't see it being feasible. They should be putting their efforts into existing manufacturers of ventilators and trying to upscale their production.
Dyson, the domestic appliance company, says it has designed an entirely new ventilator and has received an order for 10,000. The government claims that mass production is only days away, but Rayner has his doubts.
They're not days away, they're going to be weeks away. And the volume that our government require and the manufacturing that's going to have to go into these, there's no quick solution.
But a quick solution is urgently required. The pandemic is expected to reach a peak here within the next 2 weeks. Britain could then be running out of ventilators fast. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, circling back kind of to where we started, supply, demand, and the price of oil. CNBC did the reporting on this. Up in Canada, a decent beer will cost you, you know, give or take $5. A barrel of Western Canada Select, their benchmark crude oil, traded today at $4.81 a barrel. Western Canada Select is not the light sweet crude most of the world wants. It takes a lot of refining to make it usable, but still, a barrel of the stuff, 42 gallons, being cheaper than a pint of beer? That's kind of wild. Holy cow, look at the time. We got to go. A little tight here on the back end. Let's just say things were down on Wall Street today. Not terribly, though. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Samantha Fields, Ben Hethcoat, Sarah Menendez, and Erica Phillips. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.